Good afternoon. Welcome to WISR 680 AM. I'm Tyler Frio, and we're going into our extended news at noon today, talking with a guest on the program is Dr. Amesh Adalja. He is a Butler native and also senior scholar and infectious disease specialist with Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Adalja, thanks again for joining the program.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So we've been hearing in the news, especially over the past couple weeks, the Delta variant. And this is the variant that has originated in India. So basically, let's start with that. What do we know about this? What should be our concerns? Where are we at in regards to the Delta variant?
So what the Delta variant is a version of this virus that's acquired a cluster of mutations that we can say for sure makes it more transmissible. It appears to be the most transmissible version of this virus that we've seen. It's unclear whether this is more dangerous in terms of how severely ill it makes people, or if the symptoms are kind of a little bit different. That's going to take some time to figure out. But what we know is that it's more contagious. So in an unvaccinated population, just by simple Darwinian laws, it's going to grow to be the most common form of the virus. That's what we've seen in countries like Israel, the UK. That's what we're seeing in certain states where there is a lot of spread because there's a lot of unvaccinated individuals. So that's the main take-home point about the Delta variant, is that if you're unvaccinated, this is likely the version of the virus you're going to get infected with, and we're going to see this spread in unvaccinated populations.
And when we're comparing this, you know, you talk about this being the most contagious. I remember a couple months ago we were talking about B117, which was a mutation of the virus that was originated in the UK. What do we know about these mutations, the differences between the two? And I think you alluded to the point, but, you know, why is the Delta variant more contagious than even what we thought was a more contagious variant in B117?
You have to remember that from the virus's perspective, if we want to speak anthropomorphically as if it has goals, all it wants to do is have its genes copied. It wants to infect more people. So the virus is constantly going to be evolving to become more efficient at transmitting from person to person. So the 117 variant, or what was called the Alpha variant or the UK variant, was one of the first that we thought of as a concerning group of mutations, because what was happening is those individuals were probably about 40% more contagious than people who are infected with the original strain. The Delta variant seems to be 40% more contagious than the Alpha variant. So this is much more contagious than the original strain. And what's happening is there's mutations specifically around the protein inside the virus that binds to your cells. It's called the spike protein. And it is evolving to bind more tightly and to bind more efficiently to the human cells, which allows it to infect much easier. And what we see in these individuals is usually, A, that it binds to the cells more tightly, which then results in, B, higher levels of virus, and C, longer durations of the virus being present in your body, which then translates into someone with the Delta variant being more contagious to others because of that cluster of mutations and how it's changed the function of the virus. And there are other variants that do similar things as well, but it seems that the Delta is the most contagious of those. But the good thing about the Delta variant, if there is anything good about it, is that our vaccines, specifically the AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson vaccines, what I call the big four vaccines, those all seem to work very well at keeping the Delta variant at bay. That's why this is becoming kind of a problem for the unvaccinated and for geographic populations where the vaccination numbers are not so high. And there's some caveats to that, depending upon who in your county or who in your state is not vaccinated.
And so when you're saying, you know, if you're a vaccinated person and you hear all this news about the Delta variant, basically you're suggesting that, hey, you have a good level of protection against this variant of COVID.
Right. All the data that we've seen on the vaccines, especially the vaccines used in the United States, is that they are highly effective against the Delta variant. That's why the message has been, we want the vaccination number to be as high as possible so the Delta variant isn't a problem for the United States the way it was a problem for India, for example. The other thing to think about is that in the United States, our vaccine system was really geared towards putting vaccine into the highest risk population, the elderly population, the nursing home population, who constituted the major risk for hospitalization. So if you look at the country as a whole, over 77% of the population above the age of 65 is fully vaccinated. So what you're going to see in many places is yes, Delta variant cases are going to go up, but they're not going to translate into hospitals in crisis because so many high-risk individuals have been vaccinated that we won't kind of have that systemic risk. It might get uncomfortable. Hospitalizations will go up, but they won't go to that level that we were worried about back in the spring of 2020 or the winter of 2020, 2021. There are some outliers, like, for example, if you're looking at Springfield, Missouri right now, it does look very rough there because they've got a lot of hospitalizations.
If we can localize this, Dr. Dalja, you know, we've kind of, you and I were talking a little bit about vaccine rates here in Butler County. So looking at those numbers, comparing those to what we know historically, because we can look at stuff at the UK, we can look at Israel, where the Delta variant is, you know, more predominant. What do you think our status locally is going to be when you're looking at vaccination rates and if and when the Delta variant would come to Butler County?
So it is incontrovertible that the Delta variant will come to Butler County or is already in Butler County. It is going to spread everywhere amongst unvaccinated populations. In Butler County, if you look at the numbers, about 48% of the total population has been fully vaccinated. So that means the majority of Butler County residents are not vaccinated. Hopefully, the people that are not vaccinated aren't the ones that are high risk for hospitalization. Of course, some of them are going to get hospitalized, but it's not uniformly. So hopefully the hospital will be resilient against this because our nursing home population, our elderly population is highly vaccinated or have some prior immunity from prior infections. But we will see Delta variant cases in Butler County. We will see Delta variant hospitalizations in Butler County. I suspect that they'll be at a pace where the hospitalizations will uptick, but they won't be something that puts the hospital in a problem worrying about ICU beds. But the thing is, we can completely make this a non-issue for Butler County by getting our vaccination numbers higher so that the county itself remains much more resilient to the Delta variant because we've got so many people fully vaccinated. So this is something that's in the hands of the residents of Butler County. The more vaccine that gets into people's arms in Butler, the less likely Delta variant disrupts Butler County life.
So what's the pitch now from a public health standpoint? You know, it's been really these mass vaccination clinics. The one at the Clearview Mall is coming to an end, moving back to the Butler Health System. Is there an approach that has to change with how we're distributing vaccines where maybe those who are vaccine hesitant can become a little bit more comfortable or get more knowledge of taking these vaccines? Because we have been hanging around these numbers, they really haven't adjusted all that much on a week-to-week basis. You know, basically vaccination rates have stalled. What can we do to change that?
The people who wanted to be vaccinated, by and large in this country and likely in Butler County, have already been vaccinated. So now we're sort of hitting a wall of vaccine hesitancy where it's not just one single thing that's keeping people from getting vaccinated. Each person has their own rationale for why they've not vaccinated. Some people may have procrastinated. Cases are down, so maybe they don't think they need it. Some people may have had prior infection and they think they don't need to be vaccinated. There are other people who have kind of fallen prey to some of the mythology out there about the vaccine that they're seeing on social media. So right now, I think the most fruitful thing is one-on-one conversations with your friends, your family members, your coworkers who are not vaccinated, trying to show them the value of this vaccine and show them how it will improve their personal life. And I think that's the way we have to move now, because it's more people getting vaccinated when it's available to them, not necessarily needing to stand in line at the mass vaccination center. I think that part is over because the bulk of the population did get vaccinated that way that wanted to be vaccinated. Now this is detailing. And I think there are ways to do this, even going door to door, knocking on doors, saying anybody need a vaccine, and using, for example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which doesn't need cold storage, isn't a single dose vaccine. That may be one way to do it. It's also something that I think employers need to do. We've seen employers all around the country start to mandate the vaccine as a condition of employment. That brings rates up. I would like to see the Butler Health System do that as well, because we know there that the vaccination rate in physicians is very high, but the vaccination, when you move out of the physician group, falls considerably. And I think that healthcare professionals, nurses, paramedics, nurses aides, they need to be examples in society for what this vaccine means and how helpful it is to your personal life. And I think the hospital should make that a condition of employment the way they've made it a condition of employment, for example, in Houston. That's something I think that will also drive drive people to get the vaccine. And I think we need to do, we just need to do, have more information and tell people it's okay to ask questions. The vaccines sell themselves, even though they're free, because there's so much data with the hundreds of millions of doses that have gone into people. We've seen how the vaccine has transformed what it looks like in Butler Hospital now in July of 2021 compared to what it looked like in January of 2021. And what changed? People got vaccinated. So I think that this is, you know, one of the most effective vaccines that humans have ever developed.
We're talking
about safety profile is excellent. So I think this is something that we need to really champion.
We're talking with Dr. Amesh Adalja. He is a senior scholar, Johns Hopkins University infectious disease specialist. We've also obviously been learning more about the complications due to COVID, specifically people talking about long COVID. Over the past 15 months, what have we learned in some of these patients who were diagnosed with COVID and are still battling those symptoms to this day?
Well, there is a group of the population that recovers from COVID, and maybe it's a mild case, that don't go back to their baseline, that they're still having difficulty with their activities of daily living, that they have difficulty concentrating, they have extreme fatigue. And this is being called long COVID. And it's a bit of a mystery. We don't understand, first of all, how frequent it is. And there's a lot of people that are under that label that maybe are different. They're not all the same. And I think we've got to do a lot more science to refine our diagnostic criteria to understand how do we describe this, how do we define it so that we can study it and that we can treat it. And that's something I think is going to be the task in the future, you know, starting now, and it's going to go something into the future. This is going to have a long tail because so many people got infected, and there is going to be a significant proportion that are not back to their baseline. What we know so far, it occurs more frequently in females. People tend to have more underlying conditions when this happens, but there are some people who have none that have long-haul symptoms. And I think this is one of the reasons why you don't want to get infected if you can avoid it. Even if you're a 20-year-old that's healthy and you're not going to get hospitalized, you're not going to get severely ill, but why take a chance on maybe a 5% chance that you might have long COVID when you can get a vaccine and completely remove that possibility from you? So I think this is another thing that people need to calculate, that obviously me thinking about public health and the country or the world as a whole, I'm very worried about hospital capacity. But on an individual health basis, this is something you don't want to get, even if you're not going to put your hospital in crisis or require hospitalization, because it's going to decrease your quality of life if you're one of those individuals who gets long COVID. So this is something that I think needs to be really put into the calculation that individuals make when they decide on the vaccine. And it's something that, you know, Butler Health System is going to take care of long COVID patients years to come. And that's going to take resources. An effort. And I think we can minimize that by getting more vaccine into people.
I want to touch upon a point, and I think you alluded to this in one of our earlier conversations, is almost the metrics of how we're going to be evaluating COVID in the future. And I think you've said we're never going to get to COVID zero. It's not going to be completely eliminated, but it's how you handle it in the future. So what metrics, because we've seen cases rise in the UK and in Israel, but it looks like because of the higher vaccination rates, that hospitalizations and mortality rates are down. What metrics should we be looking at in terms of making public health decisions here in the future?
To me, throughout this pandemic, the metric that should guide public health measures is hospital capacity, because we're all tied together through the hospital system, like it or not, based on the system we have in the United States. And that's what flattening the curve was always about. It was about preserving hospital capacity, keeping cases to a level that didn't inundate the hospital system. So that's the metric that I think needs to be kept in mind. The whole goal of the vaccination program wasn't to drive COVID to zero. It was to drive it as low as possible. But the real primary aim was to decouple cases from hospitalization, serious disease, and death. That's why we gave the vaccine first to the elderly population, to the nursing home population, because that's who constituted the majority of people who were getting vaccinated. So what we were trying to do was not eradicate COVID-19. We can't magically have it go back into bats. What we were trying to do is tame it or defang it, remove its ability to cause a public health emergency. But what's going to happen in the future is it's going to become a seasonal respiratory virus like four other coronaviruses before it. And we're going to have COVID cases 5 years from now, but they're going to occur at in a context where they don't have the ability to infect all these high-risk people and put a hospital into crisis. I think the United States is largely there with some mild exceptions in certain parts of the country where there's not enough vaccine in high-risk individuals, where they still have uncomfortable levels of hospitalizations like Springfield, Missouri, but that's not the norm, and that can be, it's not systemic. And that's what Israel has achieved. That's what the UK has achieved. That's where we're going with this. So eventually this will be something that we think about as more like influenza. Early on, that type of analogy was wrong because influenza can't kill the way COVID-19 was killing. But now that's what it's becoming more, a tamer virus, because so many high-risk individuals have been protected with vaccines, because so many people have already been infected and have some degree of natural immunity.
And you make that point, and you know this also, I think messaging has been very important in this, and it gets at something that's just even happened over the past week where the World Health Organization is saying, even if you're fully vaccinated, we're suggesting you mask up. Meanwhile, the CDC is saying, no, that's not the case. And now you're getting to the point where you want almost the public to reframe their mindset that if you are fully vaccinated, you can think of this as influenza. When talking about mistakes that we've collectively made as a society in regards to our response to the pandemic, what are some areas that you're looking at and saying, we made a mistake there and we should have done this?
The biggest mistake is the fact that there was a lot of evasion about what this virus represented back in January and February and half of March of 2020, when decisive actions could have been taken, when we could have had better testing, we could have had the private sector and university labs engaged in testing, but instead we used the botched CDC test. We could have told hospitals, this is going to come, this is going to be something that you're going to have to prepare for, so let's make sure you have enough personal protective equipment, that you think about ventilator supply. We could have replenished our strategic national stockpile after the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. None of that happened. We could have had much better political leadership that really looked at this as a scientific public health issue and did not kind of integrate politics into it to make it so much harder to talk to the general public. We could have treated our scientists and our experts better instead of having campaigns against them and death threats against them, including threats that I get all the time. That could have all been done better. But the biggest thing is that we have to get the government at all levels, federal, state, and local, to think about infectious disease emergencies, to think about pandemic preparedness as part of national security, and to fund it sustainably, to not allow our public health agencies to become basically neglected for decade after decade, unable to do contact tracing, unable to hire people. This has to be something that we never let happen again, because we hold the government accountable for what they did to us. This is a failure of the federal government, the state governments, the local governments. That's what caused COVID-19 to be so bad, because there was wrong actions taken. And it's not as if we didn't know what to do. I work at a think tank where we write report after report, give seminar after seminar on Capitol Hill, at the White House, at the WHO, everywhere you can imagine, we're plugged in. People knew what to do here. It's just that there wasn't the political will to execute it, or there was people who just did not want to face what was going to be coming. And I think the United States could have been more like Taiwan, where they jumped into action December 31st, 2019, because there was just a rumor about something spreading in China. And they were proactive, and they met cases as they came. Instead, we did the opposite. We gave an efficiently spreading respiratory virus 2.5 month head start. And we basically crippled the CDC by politics. We crippled doctors' ability to test for this by using a botched CDC test. And then you left governors with these very blunt tools, because we had no way of knowing who was infected and who wasn't. And they were panicked and scared. And that's what the whole story of this is. And then the same thing repeated again in the summer, because no decisive action was taken in terms of hiring enough contact tracers and fortifying public health and testing. And the same thing again happened in winter. So that's what we have to fix. I think it's a colossal failure until we actually got the vaccine. That was the only way the U.S. got out of this, because we did all of the other public health parts extremely, extremely bad, where we were in this false alternative between lockdowns and Mardi Gras for everybody. And that's basically how the U.S.'s trajectory went. And it led to 600,000 deaths, including hundreds of deaths in Butler County, that many of which could have been prevented.
And one final note, on another note, how should we celebrate the 4th of July?
If you're a fully vaccinated person, you should celebrate because you're independent of the virus. So it can be a 4th of July celebration, just like the one in 2018 or 2019. Feel free to really do things without worry of COVID-19. Unvaccinated people, I would be careful. If you're in crowded, congregated places, especially indoors, I would think about wearing a mask, especially in the midst of the Delta variant. And there are Delta variant cases in Western Pennsylvania. I would try to do things outdoors as much as possible. Hopefully the weather will allow that to to be something that you can do outdoors if you're unvaccinated. So I think what we'll see is kind of two different ways of approaching this if you're vaccinated or unvaccinated. But I do think that cases are down in Butler County. Hopefully there's not going to be a big upsurge of cases after the 4th of July in Butler County because so many people have been vaccinated and so many activities can be done outdoors where transmission is less likely. But I think, you know, 4th of July is going to be much more like the 4th of July of years past than it was than the 4th of July of last year. And you know, even the big Butler Fair is back.
He's Dr. Amesh Adalja, Butler native and infectious disease specialist and senior scholar with Johns Hopkins University. As always, Dr. Adalja, thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And enjoy the rest of the weekend. You're listening to WISR 680 AM.